So, we're going to go from now until 2:15, and we'll take a break and then come back. And then this afternoon, my hope is to give us some time at the end of our day for some questions and answers, at least questions. I don't know that I'll have any answers, but I'll give you time for some questions. And also, I think that the question has been, if you have something that you'd like to ask me by email, you could do that, if that's something you'd like to do. And I'll give it to you now. It's Kurt. It's very simple. Kurt at, so it's C-U-R-T, Kurt at beingknown.com. BEINGKNOWN.com. Okay, good. Is that okay? Got that? No, I can't. I only say it once a month. But this month's nearly over, so I might say it. Okay, so sorry, that's just so rude of me, isn't it? So CURT at BEINGKNOWN.com. All right? So, how many of us feel like you're drinking from a fire hose? Yeah, well, good luck. Now, here's the thing. It's really true that anything that is really worth doing is going to be hard to do. It's going to be hard to do. Now, not hard meaning it's going to require, a PhD in applied physics to do it, but hard meaning it's going to require effort. It's going to require intentional, repeated effort to allow your mind and your body and your community to take things in and allow them to be part of who you are. There's just no two ways about that. And this is hard work, but it's good work. It's life-changing work. And I'm not saying that because, I'm the one who's talking about it. I'm saying it because, this is the work of God. God is really serious. And how hard is it? It will kill you. This is what it does to Jesus, right? He kills him. But apparently, we are worshiping a God who would rather die than let anything stand between him and us. That's how hard this is. So, as we start this next part of our day, I want to give you a bit of some shorthand. Okay? We'll pull back on the fire hose. It's a bit of a shorthand. And anything that we're going to talk about going forward, this will be a way, not the only way, but a way for you to think about, to reflect on anything, for the most part, that the mind is doing, including those nine different domains that we just talked about before lunch. And it's the acronym SIFT-B, SIFT-B. So to sift your mind, if you want to sift your mind at any given time of the day, you can ask yourself, to what degree am I sensing, imaging, feeling, thinking? I sense, image, feel, think. So sensations, images, feelings, thoughts, and behaviors. How am I behaving? What am I doing literally? Not just with my body that's measurable, because we behave in our mind as well. Actions eventually emerge out of things that our brain is doing, thoughts and sensations, so forth. But that's SIFT-B. For the most part, that's what most of the mind is doing most of the time. It's sensing, imaging, feeling, thinking, and behaving. That's what it's doing. That simply. And so we can ask those questions at any time. What am I sensing? What am I imaging? We talked earlier about the power that takes place in the right brain when we picture things that are far more powerful and quick to act in our minds than what we are thinking. My sensing, imaging, feeling, thinking, and how is that leading to behavior at any given time? And then leading from there right into this next topic, we want to talk about this idea of emotion. And as you'll see, what we've written is that from the standpoint of interpersonal neurobiology, we like to say that emotion is the energy around which the brain organizes itself. It's written there, so you don't have to write it. But the emotion is the energy around which the brain organizes itself. Even people who do research on this, on emotion, have very different ways of understanding what it is. And there's no universal agreement, no consensus statement about what it is, but there are some agreements. And one of those major agreements is that we do really believe that if you were to take emotion out of the human equation, human beings would stop moving. So the question is not, is he emotional or not? Oh, I know that's a question that you ask. The question is, in what way is emotion being demonstrated? Emotion is always taking place. In fact, the Latin root of this, amota, emotion, it's that which precedes movement, that which precedes motion. Anything that we do is going to be preceded by, and especially preceded even in micro to nanoseconds. It's going to be preceded by things that we feel. And so there's nothing that we do. We like to say no human being in the end ultimately ever does something because it makes sense. We do things primarily because of what we feel. Emotion is the energy in the tank that is fueling everything. Imagine what your life would be like if you took away all anxiety, fear, joy, motivation, hate, anticipation. All that stuff's emotion. What would be left to do if we don't have any of that stuff? And so a large part of what we attune to is this movement of emotion that's taking place all the time within us, all the time. The question is, how are we at any given time regulating that in a way that is effective? Neuroscientists like to talk about brains. If you take away any purpose for the human race, any purpose of the brain, it's like one of the things that the brain does can be described as just, it's one big emotional regulating machine. It's what it's doing. It's regulating emotion all the time, even when you're asleep. You ever have dreams that you remember? You feel things, right? Like your body, your brain is like it's regulating emotion, even when you're sleeping. The degree to which we pay attention to emotion and recognize that emotion, interestingly enough, is not just this abstract thing that I feel. So, for instance, if I have a sense of butterflies in my stomach, that's emotion. If I have tension in my hands, that's emotion. It's not just I feel angry or I feel sad or disappointed or happy. Those also are emotions. But emotion, because the mind is not just in my brain, emotion is throughout my entire system. So you're regulating a lot when you're regulating emotion. But one of the most common ways that we begin to explore emotion is around the question of what we feel. Now, it's a common thing when I'm seeing patients, or especially when I'm seeing couples, to ask people the question, what are you feeling? And invariably, people are likely to tell me what they think, right? What are you feeling? I feel that you think I'm an idiot. I said, that's not a feeling. You may be right, but it's not a feeling. You know, psychiatrists don't typically say these things to their patients. Well, I think you, and it's what we think. With couples, it's even better. What do you sense that she's feeling? Okay, here's the story. So the couple sitting in my office, and this is a couple where there had been, this is a guy, he was an engineer. Any engineers here? Yes, okay, we're not talking about you, okay? Okay. All right, the engineer, and this is a guy who's like wicked smart, and he really, really, really wanted to be able to do the right thing in his marriage. And so they're talking about whatever the nature of the problem is. And as she starts to talk about something that he had done that had really been hurtful for her, she, of course, starts to cry. And, you know, I hate it when women do this, when they start to cry. I have to work on this, right? Because then you feel so, you feel like you want to fix this, right? Men, don't you want to do that? You want to fix these things. Yeah. So she starts to cry. And I ask him, what do you sense that she's feeling? And the guy, like, I mean, you can tell. He looks at her, and you look at him looking at her, and he doesn't say anything. I'm thinking, like, it's the death march. And he doesn't say anything. And, of course, the longer he doesn't say anything, the worse she cries. And the worse she cries, the more his knuckles whiten. And he's thinking, thinking, thinking. And we were eventually able to ask him, like, so what's happening within you? And he says, I can't figure out what's going on in her mind. I said, now, isn't that interesting? I'm not asking you to tell me, like, what you think is happening in her mind. I'm asking, what do you sense that she's feeling? And his whole, like, his, I mean, like, this is a guy, like, he's a good guy. He wants to love his wife well. And he is in his left brain. And he's got a left brain that is the size of Saskatchewan. Like, part of him couldn't even get in my office because that side of his head is so big. Right? He's got this permanent kink in his neck because he's like this all the time. Because but he's working hard to do what he does well because this is what he does all day long. He does this 8-9 hours a day. And then you come home and expect him to use the other part of his brain that he doesn't practice with. And so frequently, even when we are attempting to engage what people feel, we sometimes haven't had much practice paying attention to what that really is like to do that. What do I feel? One of the things that we know about the way the brain works is that in order for me to feel what somebody else is feeling, I first have to be able to sense my own emotional state because it is my emotional state that registers what yours is. We talk about 8 different senses that we have. You've all heard of 5 senses. You heard of that, right? All these senses that you sense things that come to you from outside the environment, the outside environment, right? Your hearing and sight and touch, so forth. Well, you have a 6th sense, and that 6th sense is exactly what you sense literally on the inside of your body, in your viscera, right? So you sense your heart rates. You sense those butterflies in your stomach. You sense the dryness in the back of your throat. You sense things internally. That's a 6th sense. A 7th sense is then what we also tend to sense in terms of what we call feelings. I feel sadness. I sense anger. I sense joy. But with the combination of these 7, I then begin, if I'm paying attention to this carefully, I then begin to sense this 8th thing. I begin to sense what someone else is sensing. I sense their nonverbal cues. I sense their facial expression. I sense their body language. I sense these things, and I have a sense that what, and I might not know explicitly, but you can look at someone and you can sense they're distressed, they're sad, they're happy, they're angry. We sense what someone else is sensing. But in order for me to do that, my own internal brain mechanism has to be on board with this. So you can see how if I'm this guy in this couple, and I haven't had much practice paying attention to what I feel in my own body, it's going to be really difficult for me to have the capacity to sense what my wife is sensing. Instead, I'm left trying to figure that out using the strengths that my brain have, which is what I think logically and linearly. Here's the good news. There are things that we can do to help him, and did help him, begin to activate parts of his right brain that weren't there before. Here's a question. When you imagine God being in your presence, what do you feel God feeling? What do you feel God feeling? I'm not asking you, what do you think God feels? I'm not asking you what your theological answer to the question, what do you think God thinks about you? I'm asking, what do you feel God feeling? Are you like Eric Little? When I run, I feel God's pleasure. You feel God's pleasure? And if you do, how do you sense that? How do you feel that? To what degree is that pleasure percolating throughout your awareness of your body, not just as a like a rational concept? How much is it playing a role in your breathing, in your conversations? When you're having a conversation with somebody at any point in time, do you imagine that Jesus, who mediates every relationship on the planet, standing, looking at you, winking at you? If we've not practiced living in a world in which we believe that that kind of God occupies it, we won't really have much capacity for imagining that he's there. And instead, we imagine very, very different things. We tell different stories instead. Does that make sense? Emotion is that thing which is helping us to regulate all of this. And from there, we move to the next part on the list there that I couldn't find for a minute. How'd you like that recovery? That pretty good? Oh yeah, there is that word salience. So I guess we're not moving to the next point. We will in a minute. Imagine a bell curve. A bell curve under which those things that are salient, those things that are worthy of my attention, that are emotionally salient, those are the things that I pay attention to in life. I don't pay attention to paint drying, typically, unless it's important to me to know whether or not the paint is dry. But I usually don't like make an appointment to just sit and watch the wall of paint dry. I pay attention to those things that are emotionally able to capture my attention, not those things that are too dull or those things that are too overwhelming. And it is those things that are emotionally salient that I pay attention to. But the thing is, a lot of things in our life starts to like stretch out to the border of that salience curve, because it's possible that there are certain things that I could feel, certain emotional states that I could enter into that represent experiences I've had in my life that have been too brutally traumatic for me. And so I might be somebody who, I just don't do sadness. I don't do that. We don't permit that in my house. Or, you know, like anybody, I don't know if anybody's had this experience. I grew up in a house where I had a dad who was just, the salt of the earth. Deeply affectionate with me and my brothers and my mom, and who loved us unconditionally. But my dad had this one phrase. Don't start crying, or I'm going to give you something to cry about. I'm like, Dad, you're not being very mindful of my emotional state. I mean, you kind of get this idea, right? So our house was not a house where it was easy to like be angry and get away with it. So that means that anger for me is an emotion that like is kind of almost outside this curve. I'm not very. I have to learn to become comfortable with this. But there's a whole range of different things that we can feel that we may or may not be comfortable with. But that means that if I'm not comfortable paying attention to things that my brain is trying to get my attention about, it may mean that there are certain elements of my relationship with this person that we're just not going to address, because the emotional states that are trying to get my attention about it are ones I won't listen to, because frankly, they're too disintegrating. They're too overwhelming. And if I practice enough not paying attention to them, sooner or later, they will cease to exist for me. Those things that we don't use, we lose. That's what that's the way the brain operates. Salience. Now we can move to the next point. We've been talking for a while about the importance of relationships and how you can't really talk about the mind without talking about the relational element of that. And now we want to talk a little more specifically about that. One element of the research that contributes to the field of interpersonal neurobiology is the research in the area of what we call attachment research. Attachment. And this, in scientific terms, applies explicitly to some work by a guy named John Bowlby from Great Britain back in the 1940s and 50s, carried on by a woman by the name of Mary Ainsworth, a Canadian, and then carried on by two people, Mary Main, Eric Hesse, and a number of other folks who've done work on both childhood and adult attachment. And the basic idea is this, that for a long time, John Bowlby, back in the 40s, most of his work was being done on kids who'd been orphaned because of the war. And the question was, what was true about some of these kids that allowed them to grow up and be fairly well-adjusted adults, and what were some of the features that meant that some of these kids didn't grow up to be those well-adjusted adults? And one of the things that Bowlby started to note was that their general health, emotional health and then behavioral health, was deeply connected to the degree to which primary caregivers, and it didn't even have to be parents, because some of these kids were coming from the continent during the war, primary caregivers were attentively paying attention to the emotional health of the kid. To the degree that parents were attuned to this, it meant that it was more likely that these would be children who would grow up to be fairly well-adjusted adults. To the degree that these kids were put off in some room with just cribs and nothing much else except food and shelter, everything was different with them. And so what we've come to find out is that the process of attachment, the process of the degree to which adult caretakers attune to and pay attention to the developing minds of the children, shapes not just that child's behavioral outcome, but changes and shapes the way that child's brain actually is connected to itself. This is what we mean when we say that relationships change the brain. The degree to which I am able to be integrated as a child is deeply connected to the degree to which I was integrated with my primary caregiver. And what does that mean for parents, for primary caregivers, to be attuned to these children? One of the things we know is that attachment, when it's working well, is all about what we call mentalization. It's a phrase. There's a guy named Peter Fonagy. He's an attachment researcher in Britain, and he talks about this idea of mentalization. Basically, what this means is it is the practice of an adult paying attention to the mental function of the child. Now, you think, well, that's common sense. I mean, people would just pay attention to kids, but you'd be surprised at how little adults can sometimes think about what's actually going on in the minds of the children that they're taking care of. And what's really good news, though, is that for those people who actually turn out to have secure attachments, is it turns out their parents were mentalizing them, meaning thinking about them, probably only about 40% of the time that those parents were actually interacting with their children. So let me be clear about this. In order for us to have healthy attachments with our kids, we don't have to be mentalizing them 100% of the time that we're with them. Even being attuned to them, thinking about them 40% of the time goes a long way in helping to create secure attachments. That's actually really good news. It means the brain has a large capacity to take a little bit of connection from the parents and go a long way with it. Does that make sense? Now, some of us in this room have grown up with experiences in which attachment didn't work so well. Maybe it wasn't totally imperfect, but it might not have been perfect. Why is attachment so powerful, and why does it have such an impact on who we turn out to be? So one thing I want to suggest is that when we read the biblical narrative, we see attachment and the ideas around it start to emerge from the very first pages. When you read Genesis chapter 1 in the creation narrative, 26 and 27, there's this interesting phrase. Because up until now, God is creating things left and right. And God said, let there be light, and there was light. And God said, da-da-da-da. And God said, let there be the Canucks, and there were the Canucks. I mean, a hockey team. I mean, there's you all, but I mean like the hockey team, right? Okay. Or maybe not. Whoever your favorite hockey team is, right? So God was in that business. And then you get to verse 26, after he's done all this other stuff, and then he says, and then God said, let us make mankind in our image. So the first thing that we see is that God doesn't say, let there be mankind. Like he said, let there be light. He has a conversation first. He wonders about it. He reflects on it. And the us who is doing the reflecting, we would suggest, is not a monad God. It is not a single person God. There is some kind of plurality going on here. This was new and different and weird in that Mesopotamian culture for somebody to be writing about a God that was relational in its very nature. Let us make mankind. There's a conversation. There's a reflective nature. God's already thinking about you before he's made you. God's already mentalizing you. You want mentalization? You read Genesis. Let us make mankind in our image, and then basically to let man live like we live. To live like we live. Make mankind in our image. Connection. So there's a guy named Jim Cohn, C-O-A-N, and he is a neuropsychology researcher at the University of Virginia. And he does these really interesting studies with college students. Like I said yesterday, because you can get college students to do anything because they'll do anything for food, right? It's awesome. And so here's what Jim Cohn has done with his cohort of college students. He's done a number of different experiments, but one of the things that he does is that check this out. He said, we're going to have you, we're going to put you in a SPECT scanner. It's a brain scanner to check out the activity of your prefrontal cortex. But we're also going to hook you up to a sensor that is able to sense amount of pain that you have. Like, this is where people get nervous. And he says, and then what we're going to do is we're going to give you a shock, an electrical shock, and we're going to measure two things. And the first thing we're going to measure is how much pain you sense. And the next thing that we're going to measure is how much distress you feel emotionally while you're feeling that pain. So they're measuring two separate things. The PET scanner is really to measure the emotional distress. And so then he does this. And he measures how much pain they experience and how much emotional distress they experience while they're experiencing the pain. And then he repeats the process. He changes one variable. And that variable is that second time around, he invites the subjects, each one of them, to hold the hand of a loved one or a very, very close friend. Then they run the test again. And here are the results. What they measured in terms of how they experienced the physical pain didn't change at all. No, which is actually a good thing because it tells them that their brain that registers physical pain is still working the way it should. What was so remarkable was that all the markers for the prefrontal cortex that would indicate high levels of distress started to drop. And so their perceived sense of distress that they were experiencing while their pain was going on was markedly different. You get this, that something already is telling us that when I am literally physically connected to somebody else, my experience of suffering is categorically different, which is why we would say suffering in the end is mostly not about the pain we experience, it is about the degree to which we are alone with what we suffer. Now, Cohn is not a believer, but he said this at the conference that he and I spoke at. He said, What our researchers are really starting to wonder is this. You know, we have all these PET scans and SPECT scans and functional MRIs that look at what the normal brain should appear to be. But all of these are done on individuals. Is it not possible that the most normal, healthy brain is a brain that gets its picture taken while it's holding somebody else's hand? That in fact what looks like a normal brain is still a brain that's under stress because it is not connected. And I thought, my goodness, have you been reading the first chapter of Genesis? Genesis chapter 2 comes along, and God, in verse 7, right, gets down in the mud, intimate, breathing the breath of life into man's nostrils, and man became a living soul. And then 2:18 comes along, and he says, you know, this whole thing of man being on his own, it's not a good thing. It is not enough. It is not enough. It is not enough that we are alone. We need more. We need us. We need each other. Attachment, then, makes actually quite complete sense, that our brains are only going to develop to the degree that someone else is connecting with me in the process of enabling my life to begin to flourish. Using all of the awareness of all these different domains that we've talked about, and the awareness of the emotion that's driving all of this train in the first place. Now, there are different kinds of attachment patterns. We could spend a whole weekend on attachment. There are libraries of research now on attachment, and we're not going to spend a lot of time, but just to give you some examples of what attachment looks like when it's secure and when it's insecure. Secure attachment means that in the course of mentalizing, in the course of someone else paying attention to what I am sensing, imaging, feeling, thinking, and behaving, and without reacting negatively to that, I now, literally, my brain now feels safe enough to allow more parts of my brain to expose itself even more so. So if I feel safe enough in your presence to talk about the truth of my life, I can do so, and therefore feel even more safe to talk about more parts of my life that yesterday I didn't feel safe enough to talk about. But there's something else that this frees me to do. It frees me to take proper risks, not just with you, but with other things outside our life. Secure attachment really means that as people feel this security of being with someone else, we talk about we-ness, we are together, and with-ness, that security is what enables me to take risks outside of our relationship. This happens all the time with little kids. You will watch them who are feeling securely attached to their parent run off and do all kinds of things. And then they will come back and they will run off and do all kinds of things. They're not worried about the dangers ahead because there is a sense within them that they have created that they are connected, they are tethered, they are not by themselves. To whom are you tethered? Who is it in your life to whom you could point? And it might not just be one person. It might be a collective net. Who are those to whom you are tethered who, because of that, create the freedom for you to go and live like God lives? Because certainly, if we are going to take Genesis 1 seriously, let us make mankind and let them live like we live. If God is a creating God, that is what we are called to do. We are called to create, and we are called to take proper risks in that creation. You think he didn't take a risk? It's a risk that kills him in the end, right? He invites us into space that allows us to be healed so that we can then take greater risks in creating more of this kingdom of beauty and goodness. But it will be hard for me to do that if I don't have some sense of being securely attached. That's what secure attachment does for us. Insecure attachment does it in a whole host of ways. Three ways that the research has shown, and they go something like this. We talk about insecure and avoidant attachment. We talk about insecure and anxious attachment. And we talk about insecure and disorganized. And just three different examples of this. You can have someone who has an insecure avoidant attachment is someone who grows up in a family where typically the parents' experience of an expression of emotion is pretty much non-existent. In other words, we grow up in a place where emotion doesn't make much sense to use. So if I try to use things emotionally and it doesn't get me anywhere, then I will stop using that emotion. Here's an example. So he comes into my office, and he's actually a pretty well-known pediatric surgeon, and he comes in at the request of his wife because he's having trouble parenting, she thinks, parenting their two-year-old son. And their two-year-old son is a little precocious, and he and the dad is just not very patient with him. A lot of impatience, a lot of raising his voice, angry, so forth. And, of course, his wife is concerned because, you know, here you've got this really well-known pediatric surgeon who can't take care of his own kid. And he was open to coming to see a psychiatrist because he wanted to be better able to parent, but he didn't know how to do that. And so we do kind of like a standard psychiatric evaluation, and we talk about a whole range of different things, and there's not a single real symptom that he admits to. He's not depressed. He's not anxious. His work, his practice is going well. But every time he comes home and is with his son, everything starts to go haywire. And so we ask some standard questions about his family. Any particular losses? Any particular traumas? No, not at all. So then we did this thing called a body scan. And a body scan is something we talk about in the book. And it's a simple practice of having someone sit, close their eyes, and literally begin in their mind to scan their body. We begin with their feet, and we ask them to start to pay attention to what they sense, feel, in these different parts of their body. I'm sure that this is a practice that you all do. Sit around and like wonder what your feet feel like. What was so striking about this was that by the time we worked our way up his body, legs, torso, and got to his abdomen, he started to speak about something that was coming into his mind. What is this? And he starts to describe a memory that he was having that he hadn't thought about in a long, long time. And the memory that he talks about is a memory of when he was about 10 years of age. And he's standing in his driveway. And he's having the memory of seeing his mother, who's standing at the end of their driveway, with his two-year-old brother, who in that memory suddenly bolts into the street and is hit and killed by a car. Now think. This guy's a rock star surgeon. Smart as a whip. And you ask him questions like, any traumas? Any losses? Nope. 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 Now, if you were to have asked him, have you ever had any siblings that have been killed in a car accident? He would have said, yes, of course, I had a two-year-old brother. But it doesn't register to him as something that he feels or something that he necessarily remembers all the time in time travel. It's something that he remembers as a fact. Just kind of like it's a fact that Christmas is on the 25th of December. Like, it's a fact. It's not a felt experience. But this was a guy who, when this tragedy happened, lived in a family of parents who didn't talk about this. Can you imagine losing your two-year-old in that way? I mean, what would any set of parents? I mean, this is horrible. But they don't talk about it. They don't talk about it with him. And so he learns over time that emotion, even this deep grief, this sense of confusion, all these kinds of things, you learn it is not helpful for you. And so sooner or later, all the emotion that was part of that experience begins to be something that he closes off, puts away, and doesn't go visit because it's way, way too dangerous. Because if I'm that 10-year-old and I'm this upset because of this event and I'm left alone with this emotional state, if my parents don't come to help me, there is no way out. Does that make sense? So that's just one example of how this kind of attachment, it doesn't mean that this surgeon's parents didn't love him. It doesn't mean that at all. They're doing the best they can. They're trying to get through the grief of having lost their two-year-old. It doesn't mean that they don't love him. They're doing the best they can, but their brains don't do the emotion thing very well, and it means that this is a kid who then goes up to not be attached. And so therefore, isn't it interesting that he's doing fine until his son is two? And all that implicit memory gets activated again every day he comes home. And now there's no getting around it. No matter how much I try to put this off, my unfinished business is coming to find me. This, you see, is what God does. He builds things into our lives such that we cannot avoid him. He is going to find you. That's both good and terrifying news. Because he's not just coming for the parts of you that you want him to see. He's especially coming for the parts that you don't want him to see, because it's not the parts that are healed that need the physician. He's coming for everything. We can also be insecurely and anxiously attached. This would be a situation in which a parent, in their own anxiety, is having a hard time really kind of mentalizing the well-being of a child. And sometimes they are with the child, and sometimes they're not with the child. Sometimes they are with the child when the child doesn't need them to be there. And so what this evokes in a child is a sense of, like, I can't really trust my parent to know when they're going to be here, when they're not going to be there. And sometimes they're going to be here when I don't want them to be here. Which means the child is left kind of perpetually anxious when it comes to the presence of relationships. Does that make sense? Some of us know what these things are like. And then we become the adults who have a hard time being comfortable when someone is either too close or they're too far away. And then we can have what we call a disorganized attachment pattern that is also insecure. And this comes in the face of people who experience certain kinds of trauma that never gets resolved. So I had a young guy who was in his 30s that I was seeing, and he recounted how when he was a kid, he had two younger siblings, and he was a young guy. His father would put them to bed, and what he would do, put them to bed, turn the lights out upstairs in their house, and then his father would start at one end of the hallway, dark hallway, all the lights out, screaming like a monster running down the hallway. I'm thinking, I'm not sure that this is a good way to put your children to bed. Now, later on, and you can imagine, if you're 2 years old, what does this do to your brain? I mean, like, you think you've gone to bed, and now it's dark, and now you've got somebody screaming in the house. Now, we kind of laugh at that, but if you're two, it's not funny. Later, when this patient of mine confronted his dad said, you know, I was just trying to, like, connect. I was just trying to have fun. Trying to pretend, you know. And, like, you know, you want to say, like, dude, like, that's a whack job. Like, that's just crazy. Like, okay, like, that's the psychiatric, like, technical term for it, right? But the point is, like, he's not a bad guy that doesn't love his kids. He loves his kids, but his own brokenness, his own life doesn't make it easy or possible for him to have a sense of what it means to mentalize your kids and think, like, gosh, I put my kids to bed. It's a good idea for them to just, like, be there now. No, he's had things that inside of him that erupt and do these kinds of things that create all these strange then experiences for kids. And so naturally my patient has these moments when in certain situations with intimate relationships, he just explodes. Because, of course, this is what happens if we find ourselves in frightening situations and we can't find our way out. We will fight to the death. And so this is what would be happening to him. He'd be on the job, like, he'd just explode over things that were seemingly small provocations. In the book, there's more detail about these different kinds of attachments. But already we can start to get a picture of what some of this stuff starts to feel like, starts to look like. And we can begin to imagine a little bit of our own story somewhere in these things. We get a sense of parts of us that feel like we didn't really learn how to do the emotion thing very well. Or we grew up with a parent who is necessarily pretty anxious about stuff. Kind of leaves us that way. Or we have these inexplicable moments that show up in which I just feel like I'm losing my mind and I don't know where any of that's coming from. Or we live with someone who wrestles with that. Here's a story, though, about what can happen When we take these things seriously enough, that we allow them to heal. Because in the middle of all this insecure attachment and all this brain disintegration that takes place as a result of it, there's an interesting thing that happens when those folks who have insecure attachments, who have disintegrated states of mind, encounter someone else who's coming to find them. Encounters someone else who's coming to find them. Calvin was 35. He was the oldest of five kids. He was the first in his family to get married and the first to have a child. And when his child was about 9 months of age, he calls his mother because his child, who's done really well developmentally, his child is starting to cause Calvin some trouble. He's an energetic young boy, and Calvin doesn't really know what to do with this, and so he wants advice from his mother. And when he calls his mother is quick to point him to his father Ed. And Calvin didn't really want to talk to Ed. He said, "Why would I talk to my dad? I never talk to my dad. My dad never talks to me about anything that's intimate. I'm talking about parents. This is your grandchild, Mom, for crying out loud. Like, you want like the right people talking to the right people here, right?" And she said, "Well, I think it would be helpful for you to talk to your dad because, as you'll discover, your dad has been through some things recently that I think might be helpful for you." She was pretty firm about this. She wasn't going to budge, and so he reluctantly hangs up, and he calls his father. And his father, who's been talking with his mother about this, knows that the call is coming. And when they start to talk, Ed begins to share with Calvin some things that Calvin didn't know. Ed said, "You know, my dad," Calvin's grandfather, he said, "you know that he was an alcoholic." Calvin had known this, though his grandfather had died by the time Calvin was born. He said, "But what you didn't know was that your grandfather, not only was he an alcoholic, but he was a brutal one. And it was not uncommon for your grandfather to become pretty physically violent with the rest of us in the house, including me, and would routinely throw us in the around the kitchen. And by the time I got old enough to think about having a family, I swore that if I ever had children, I would never do to them what he did to us. And then we had children. We had five of them, as you know. And as you also know, whenever anything that would come up emotionally that was distressing in the family, I let your mother handle it. Because I was going to make sure that I never did what my father did to me. So I took care of making sure you had food on the table, a roof over your head, clothes on your back, that you went to mass, that you got to college. But I wasn't really able to do much more than that because every time emotional stuff would start to show up, it made me too nervous. He said, "But then you had a boy. And when you had that baby, it undid me. Because now I had a chance to have a relationship with a kid that I wasn't responsible for, and I didn't know how to do it. And it started to make me really upset. And it made me upset at home, so much so that your mother said, 'You got to go talk to this guy.' So into my office walks 63-year-old Ed with this story. Now, Ed was a pretty straightforward guy. He thought he was coming in to just feel better. Little did he know. He didn't know that he was coming in to talk about the brain. He didn't know that he was coming in to talk about how he talks about his story. He didn't know that he was coming in to discover that there were parts of his life he didn't know he didn't know. And part of what was hard for Ed was that he was sure that because he was 63 years old, there was no way he could make changes. He'd been living for this many decades this way, and how do you change after this much life? I'm like, well, gosh, you know, Abraham was living 75 years and God decided he was going to change his life. And Moses was living 80 years. He decided he was going to change his life. You're 63, and it sounds like through the birth of your grandson, God's about to change your life. So we start to do a lot of this work. We talk about attachment. We talk about storytelling. We give him exercises to do for neuroplasticity. We start to help him begin to connect with things that he feels emotionally. Sensations, images, feelings, thoughts, all these kinds of things. And Ed's brain starts to wake up. Now, part of the challenge is it doesn't just wake up to good things. It wakes up to really painful things as well. And so part of the work that we had to do was to help him learn how not just to feel emotion that he enjoyed, like this deep joy about his grandson and his longing to be connected to his son, but his rage about his father. And what does it mean if you grew up in a Catholic home, but brutality and the absence of forgiveness is the story you know? Who is that God? We could say, even in this room, there are people who would be asking that same question. And so part of the work involves reintroducing Ed to different stories about the gospel and about who this God is that has come. What does that mean to have a God who has come? And as Ed began to become more flexible and adaptive and coherent and so forth, he started to go home and start to talk to his wife. And he would talk more and more to his wife. He talked so much to his wife that I got a phone call from his wife who said, "What have you done with my husband?" She had gotten used to life, 40 years worth with this man. She said, "I only wanted one marriage. I have it. I don't want a second. I don't want a marriage to a different guy, and I'm married now to a different guy." Because we had our routine, right? I didn't expect him to talk to me about these things. I've got my girlfriends, for crying out loud. I don't need my husband to do this. And of course, you see, this is what happens. Jesus shows up, heals one person, and everybody else gets upset about it. Oh, we like the idea of healing, but the actual event of healing is a whole other kettle of fish. This is what we know. There will be people in your life when you find that you are moving from insecure to secure attachment. There will be people in your life who will be so pleased, and then there will be people who will fight you tooth and nail to not let it happen. She got over it. But as Ed worked on his story, eventually it came time for him to talk to Calvin. Now, here's the beautiful thing about this. Calvin, of course, is listening to his dad tell him these stories, tell him what's all this going on. And Calvin, of course, has no idea who he's talking to on the other end of the phone. And over time, Ed began to have regular phone calls with Calvin. And then they went to see each other. I mean, they lived in different cities. And here's what's really interesting. As Ed began to pursue his own son, to ask him to do, to tell his story and so forth, Calvin began to report that his parenting of his own son began to change. You see this? If we were to have had these three men hooked up sequentially to PET scans throughout the course of this time, we would see that not only does Ed PET scan change, but so does his grandson's. And his grandson can't even talk. You see, this is what the gospel is about. It is this ripple effect. This sense that when Jesus comes and sheds light and heals you, it will be inevitable that the healing that takes place in you will extend to anybody that you touch. Calvin's parenting change and Calvin's son's life will change forever because of what that little boy's grandfather decided to do. Whose life is going to be changed because you decide to do the work that Ed decided to do. One of the things that we say about helping to create secure attachment in our children and in those around us with whom we are well, with whom we're intimately connected, is this. The single most powerful variable that enables parents to engender secure attachment in their children is whether or not the parents have made sense of their own life story. You can take parenting classes, that's a good thing. You can exercise, that's a good thing. You can have your kids involved in the right schools, right athletics, that's a good thing. But the single most powerful thing you do, there are a lot of variables, the single most powerful variable is whether or not you have made coherent sense of your own life story. That brings us back to that coherent word, FACES, flexible, adaptive, coherent, energized, and stable. And that word coherent here is referring to that I am making sense of my life in its full capacity. I don't just know my life in terms of the facts. I don't just know my life in terms of, like, I know where I was born, who my parents were, and where I went to fifth grade. It's that I am making sense of all the emotional states that I carry, all the memory that I carry, all the ways that I have had had painful stuff happen that I'm now moving into the light for forgiveness and healing. All that is about coherence. To the degree that we allow all of our life to come into the light is the degree to which healing takes place, and that is commensurate with the degree to which we are known. I'm only able to develop a coherent narrative to the degree that that narrative is known by someone else. I cannot figure that out all by myself. Back again to one of our original questions. By whom are you known? By whom are you known? So we have a couple of things that we can help people do to begin to help them know their story better. So here's one thing. I don't know if anybody here has done this or not, but we invite people frequently to write their autobiography. And by this, a couple of logistical issues about it. Number one, we're not looking for war and peace. Okay? So you can be glad for that, in that we're not looking for you to feel like you have to write down every detail. But we like you to write a decade at a time. So it would go something like this. If we were going to do this exercise, I would say, I want you to write about the first 10 years of your life. And I want you to write about it for maybe 45 minutes or an hour at the most. You don't need to write more than that. Begin with your earliest memory and write what you can. I want you to do it by hand. I don't want you to keyboard it. I want you to do it by hand because by hand does a number of things in the brain that allows the brain's right hemisphere to do work in connecting with the left that is more difficult for it to do if I'm keyboarding, because there's a lot of automatic bypassing that takes place when I keyboard. If I have to write with my hand, everything about the process slows down. If it slows down, it gives my brain time to catch up. It activates other memories. It activates other feelings. And now that I'm writing, bless you, now that I'm writing this, I now have a sense of other things that are being activated. And we even say, look, if it reminds you of something that happened in a different decade, fine, write it down too. Handwriting, decade at a time. And then give it a few days, come back and write about your next decade, same way. And then about your next decade and so forth. And then I want you to find somebody that you trust, really trust. And I want you to read it to them. Now, you know, I see patients who pay me to tell them to do this, and they don't want to do it. I mean, first of all, it's scary enough for them to have to think about their life, for some, like, let alone write it on paper where someone else could find this, let alone now say it out loud to someone else who now knows it, who can own it, who can do something with it that I can't control for. Are you kidding? We want someone that we can trust, that we can read this to, who's willing to ask us questions. And there are five interrogatories that we encourage people to ask. In the English language, these interrogatories are who, what, where, when, and how. There's also the other one, which is why. We encourage people, where it's possible, not to use that word. Because why questions, in our language, why questions are often not just questions. They're often statements. Why were you so late picking me up? I'm not really asking that question as if knowing the answer to that will help me. I'm really making a statement. Who, what, where, when, and how? Wow. Thank you. That's what, okay, that new technique. I have to learn that. Who, what, where, when, and how are words that we can use to acquire information. We really do want to acquire information. I'm not interested in judging your behavior. I'm interested in knowing your behavior. I want you to be known. I don't want you to be judged. Some of us are really terrified of letting anything about certain parts of our story out because we know that judgment is coming. Does that make sense? We know this. I mean, there are certain things that spouses aren't going to tell spouses. We're not going to talk about it because I know how he gets when I do or how she gets when I do. I'm not going there. This is hard work. We're going to talk more about this when it comes to confession and forgiveness later on. But that's just one example of how we can begin to become more familiar with our narrative, more familiar with putting ourselves in a position in which our attachment patterns can begin to change because we are allowing other people who can have access to me in a different way than what these other people have had in my history change the nature of how my brain is being wired in this moment. In the same way, that the conversations between Ed and Calvin would change Calvin's brain forever. The same way that Ed's brain would change because he allowed himself to allow me to ask him questions. Who's asking you questions? That's not rhetorical. It would be important for you to be able to leave here today having written down the names of the people who you know are going to ask you questions. And if we don't have them, we need to find them. Okay, we're in a tricky place because we're supposed to take a break in 10 minutes. But we're ready to start this next section, which is going to take more than 10 minutes. So we could take the break now. I think we'll do that. And so we'll move our schedule ahead by 10 minutes. And so that means that we're going to be back here at 2:25. And then we're going to go till 4. Does that work? Does it work? Okay.